This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
240 years ago, on the 13th of March, 1781, William Herschel discovered the planet Uranus. Almost two centuries later, on the 10th of March 1977, a group of scientists on board the Kuiper Airborne Observatory made a new discovery about the planet. In 1977, today's interviewee, Jessica Mink, was working at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, along with her colleagues James Elliott and Ted Dunham. On the 10th of March, they predicted that an occultation by the planet Uranus, where it passes in front of a background star, would give them a unique chance to look at the planet's atmosphere. What they actually found was something unexpected. The planet had rings. Jessica takes us back to the time as they were preparing to investigate the occultation.
The job came through in late September, and I worked for Jim Elliott. And he had a small group doing occultations. And he had, because there was a Neptune occultation, maybe Neptune, in 1975, that they hadn't been able to get because it got, they went to two different places to do observations, and both times that year, it was cloudy. Mm-hmm. So he decided, we're not going to do this anymore. So in 76, in the summer, before I got there, they flew on the Kuiper Airborne Observatory for the first time. Jim Elliott, Ted Dunham, and an undergraduate, and they observed an occultation by Mars, where they actually got a central flash. So the star was exactly opposite behind Mars, and you get a flash all the way around the atmosphere if that happens. And you can.
I didn't know that.
Interesting things. And Jim had an embroidered shirt that had the Mars central flash that he always wore for occultations. That was his lucky shirt. And we had a whole bunch of good luck charms that we had when we were going observing. And so I started in September. The occultation by Uranus was going to happen in March 10th. We were going to go fly on the KO again. It was pretty exciting. Sort of the end of February, I flew there to California with my group. And we had this pretty good setup. So the way it worked was I did all the software and it interfaced with the computer, the flight computers, to get the data onto our data recorder. I didn't have to actually do the electronics. I just had to make sure I could read the data and follow things in close to real time. And Ted made sure that the data system worked okay. And Jim made sure the flight did the right thing. So there's the three of us, and we split off in the morning and go to three different buildings. I'd be in what they called the cave, where the computers were, and talk to all the people that ran the computers on the plane. And Ted would go to the lab where the crate was. It was a big instrument crate that was flight ready. So all the screws were weird torque screws. They weren't Phillips head or straight. They were torque. And he had to have a special tool on. And then Jim was off in the offices talking to the administrative people to make sure we were flying in the right places. And it was quite a thing to do. And I had barely been to I'd been to California once in my life. Really staying in one place. It was sort of fun though, because all the people, I also had never worked with a bunch of like scientific software people before. So it's sort of fun to work with them. And I sort of knew what I was doing pretty quickly, but I could ask questions of everybody. It was a whole new system that was Hewlett Packard computers, because they were the only people that would certify them for flight altitudes. They set it up so that we fly whatever altitude we have to fly at to be above the clouds. Mm-hmm. If you fly above 41,000 feet in a C-141, you have to have high altitude training.
Yeah.
So C-141s had this problem that sometimes they have a tail door that they use for loading because it's a cargo plane. And it has been known to pop open.
Right.
And the plane will decompress. And this is not a good thing to have happen if you're very high up.
No.
Over 13,000 feet. So if you're going it, you're required like every, I don't know how many years it was, you're required to have high altitude training, which you get at a military base. I ended up joining two B-52 crews in their periodic high altitude training because they all had to have it. So I'm at the Air Force base. I'm getting trained. You know, classroom where you learn disorientation. Then they take you to the high altitude chamber and you go. The first thing you do is they slowly decompress you. And they take you up. And the idea is so you learn what your hypoxia symptoms are, because they differ from person to person. So you get paired off with another person. One of them, you wears an oxygen mask, the other one doesn't. And you do things like play tic-tac-toe and count backwards from 100 by threes and things like that. And then you're supposed to gradually see symptoms like your vision might narrow or things happen, or you might pass out. The idea being that you should see the symptoms coming if you're piloting an airplane. Mm-hmm. And I got a tail gunner as my partner, and tail gunners have a reputation. So I kept beating him at tic-tac-toe, like as I was being decompressed. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if I've really had a strong symptom. I'm a bicyclist and I live at sea level, but I bike a lot. And I did then especially. Mm-hmm. And I think that made a difference. I was in pretty good shape. And then the other thing they do is they take you up to 27,000 feet and then explosively decompress you. Mm-hmm. But you see what that's like. So when you know about when the oxygen drops in an airplane and everything, well, we got to experience that in real life, except on the ground, which is a lot better than experiencing it in the air. Because what happens is the whole room instantly fogs up, like instantly, and you can't see anything. So it's very disorienting. So it's really good to take that test and learn how to deal with that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and then I went back and we took off and we flew to, we were flying from Australia, which was sort of really cool too, because I'd never been to Australia. I wanted to go there. So we flew to Hawaii the first day. Oh, and the other thing was the NASA pilots didn't really like to fly for more than 4 hours at a time if they could help it. Mm-hmm. And they were really good pilots. Some of them were like later people that flew the shuttle back and forth. So they would fly us. We flew to Hawaii. So I'd never been to Hawaii. So that was my first night in Hawaii. We stayed in the Hilton Hawaiian Village. I could look down on Waikiki Beach. It was pretty cool. The next day we flew to American Samoa and we sat outside the Rainmaker Hotel in the afternoon and watched the clouds form over the Rainmaker volcano. Snorkeled on the reef, which was right next to the hotel. And it was really cool. And we had a meteorologist on the plane with us. And so he would tell us about what was happening in the atmosphere So we sat and talked to him, looked at what was happening in the atmosphere. He described as really educational. And then we flew from there to, I think, to Melbourne. Mm-hmm. I don't remember anything about Melbourne. And then we flew from there to Perth. And all this starts to blur after a while. And in Perth, we had two flights. We had a test flight where we only went out for 10 hours over the Indian Ocean. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember whether we took data on, like, just shot Uranus by itself and the star by itself, which is what I think we would have done, but I don't remember what we did. Mm-hmm. It might be in Jim's book, but I don't know. And then we flew back, and I don't remember when I did what. Somewhere in all this time, I went to the zoo with a bunch of other people and got to see kangaroos live in person with grade school people who were got really these good demonstrations of. We got to stand in a kangaroo enclosure and look at the kangaroos. So it was sort of fun. And then we had our big flight, which was 11 hours long, which was pretty long. Mm-hmm. We flew from Perth to the Kerguelen Islands. And we flew on this arc so that we were tracking Uranus mm-hmm. on our way out. And we watched the occultus. So the plan was that we would watch for quite a while before and quite a while after. Because we could keep, because you were above the clouds, we could just, and we were going, we were just have total darkness for a long time. That was the good thing.
And was it just to get above the clouds was the reason that you needed to be in the Airborne Observatory?
Well, also it was useful to be, if you wanted to be over the Indian Ocean for the best view of the event, it really helped to be in an airplane.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah, it's two things. The clouds are really important, and that's a big point. And because, I mean, I've tried lots of occultations, and I've had like lots of, too many times when, like there was a time I was observing a comet occultation in Central Florida, mm-hmm. and the sky was so murky that we couldn't identify the stars even. This is before you had telescopes that aimed themselves, but there were so few stars in the sky that we couldn't figure out where to aim the telescope. So I think we missed from that. And another time I was in, actually observing in near here in our 60-inch telescope in the country outside of Boston. And we're doing a multispectral observation of an occultation by Aldebaran, I think. And to see if we could see difference in the atmosphere, different wavelengths of the star. And it was a lunar occultation. And right before it went in, the clouds came in, so we didn't get to see it go behind the moon. And then right after it came out, the clouds went away. So we got mm-hmm. no data from the whole night of that, waiting for this
one. It's always the way. The second there's something really interesting, that's when the clouds roll in.
So anyway, so that's why you fly in the Airborne Observatory. It's a big deal to do this. It's got a huge crew. We mm-hmm. had to take like maintenance people with us, and we had to have multiple pilots. And, it was a big deal. And the Kerguelen Islands are really far away and in the middle of nowhere. I finally, a couple of years ago, I was at a conference. A meteorology conference, and I talked to somebody who actually had worked in the Kerguelen Islands and got to ask about them. But it was really a lot of the trip was over nothing. And in fact, we went off, wasn't as good satellite coverage in the 70s, and mm-hmm. we were unreachable for a while, and they mobilized but didn't send out air sea rescue. Mm-hmm. That was the same area where a flight disappeared out of Malaysia, I think, the Malaysian Airlines flight. And you can sort of see why, because there's literally nothing there. And in the days before continuous photographic coverage of the Earth, you know, it was pretty, so we were lost for a while. And, mm-hmm. And then we had it turned around. So we watched it. We saw blips before we got to the planet. We saw these blips, and that was interesting. So we thought, oh, it looks like there's a satellite belt or something. And what's cool about this mission is because the airplane is noisy, everybody has a headset with a mic and everything gets recorded. So we have there is a full recording of everything we said on the airplane that night, including a lot of dumb things that I said. But I did say there's a belt of satellites. And then we got the occultation of the atmosphere. And then it came out, got a second occultation, immersion. And then we saw more blips on the other side. And it was really cool because of the airplane. We had this long record of both sides. And if we hadn't been on the airplane, we wouldn't have had the whole record. Because it was a lot of time. I don't remember how many hours, but it was a pretty long time.
So what was it that you'd been looking for in the first place?
We were looking at the atmosphere. Because there was actually a controversy about whether the features you would see in the atmosphere were caused by atmospheric structure or turbulence in the atmosphere. Is the density in the atmosphere continuously vary, or on the scale of a star radius, apparent star radius, are you seeing turbulence? So there were two schools of thought. And the general idea was the more events you see, the more you'll figure out what it is. And there had been I don't even know what year it was, occultation of Beta Scorpii, which is a really bright star. Well, it sounds like it would be a really bright star by Jupiter several years earlier. And the problem with Beta Scorpii, it turns out to be that it's two double stars plus a third star, or fifth star. And so when it goes through the atmosphere, you have very high resolution and you can separate all these different things out. So all the different spikes you see in the atmosphere as the occultation happens, there's actually five different occultations going on. And you have to figure out which you're seeing what of as it goes through, and it's challenging. And I don't know if it ever totally got, there are a bunch of papers on that event. I did some lunar occultations of it to look at it later on. And it was complicated to do things with that. But you can separate them out really well in a lunar occultation. And it's trickier to separate the two close binaries, but you can separate out the three stars. So for ours, it was a single star. That was simple. The problem was that there was other things that blocked it. And we had a chart recording. And there's a copy in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, but it's not our original one because our original one was too big to put in a display case and see something on it. So I actually played back the data with the chart moving slower. And that's what we put in the Smithsonian. But what happened was, after the flight, we sent a telegram to the Central Bureau for Astronomical Telegrams, which happens to be, at that point anyway, it was down the hall from where my office is now, and in Cambridge, Massachusetts, USA, not the other Cambridge. We call that one the other Cambridge. They call ours the other. Anyway, they were first. We admit that. And so it's sort of cool because it was written down and then radioed in. And so that's when they got, by the time they got that, we were back on, and they knew we weren't lost, and they called off the air sea rescue. We land, and so they sent in. So it's sort of cool. So there's the handwritten note that the pilots read from is in the Smithsonian institution in Washington, also in the Air and Space Museum, in a separate exhibit, but they're both there. Anyway, we landed. It was 95 degrees Fahrenheit on the runway. We had an air conditioner.
Which is hot for our British listeners.
Yes, it is hot for your British listeners. Not something you get very often. And we were, I had to stay on the plane to shut down the systems and everything and make sure, lock down the tapes, all these useful things with the data. Jim and Ted went back to Perth from the airport with the charts. And so I went back with one of the other programmers, and later, a couple, I don't know, an hour later, 2 hours later. And I think I went straight to bed. They'd been up and then they went to bed.
An 11-hour flight plus getting there and getting back.
And we didn't really sleep on that flight. And so I had to work after the flight and then go back. And anyway, in the course of this, they had folded out the chart and then folded it back on itself and found out that the lines lined up. So they had that immersion of the planet, which you could fold over for sure. You know, that's going to be symmetrical. And then the other lines lined up pretty well. And so we found five rings. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, on the ground at Perth Observatory was Bob Millis and somebody from Perth Observatory, whose name I don't remember. Bob Millis was from Lowell Observatory in Arizona. So there's this MIT Lowell collaboration that has been still ongoing after all these years. Well, then it was a Cornell Lowell. Now it's MIT Lowell. And he got only one side, but he saw more rings closer to the planet. So there are alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon are the five rings we saw, and his rings are 4, 5, and 6. And I think 1, 2, and 3 might be some of the rings we saw. I don't really know exactly what 1, 2, and 3 are, but I know 4, 5, and 6 are the rings they saw, which are real rings, but we didn't see them in our data because they're narrower and the pen just went, and we didn't see that. I think we could find them in the data later, but the chart recorder was not the real data. The real data was on data on magnetic tapes.
Mm-hmm. And so the chart recorder was just the sort of pen moving across the paper to show you what was happening.
Right.
But then you later had the recordings to go into later.
Yeah. So I had a digital watch and I actually held my watch up next to the chart recorder at one of the events as a like backup. So we could see that there was a time when something happened. So the data on the tapes was time tagged. And the problem we had was that we didn't have a hard disk drive back in Ithaca even. So we had to put things on cassettes, like they're digital cassettes that are like audio cassettes, because that's the kind of cassette there was in 1977. Mm-hmm. And they're built a little differently, but they hold 50 kilobytes per cassette, which is not a lot of data.
That is not a lot. Because most pictures are now, 20 times that?
Yeah. It's like not a lot. So on the way back, I had a carry-on bag, which had like 10 9-track magnetic tapes. Like these are the big ones. Mm-hmm. With our data on it, and we didn't want them to go anywhere. We wanted them to go with us on the plane, and they barely fit under the seat, and seats had more space under them in those days too. But the 747 SP, which we flew back on from Australia, from Sydney to San Francisco, I called it the squish passenger. So three of us sat in a row on like seats A, B, and C on the plane. And Jim's like 5'10 or something. But Ted's 6'3 and I was 6'2. And our legs didn't fit. So we're sitting there sort of scrunched up with these mag tapes, which were really probably too heavy to be carry-on baggage, but they didn't enforce it too much. And we would have really pleaded with them if they didn't let us take them. So we flew back commercial, and the Airborne Observatory stayed in Australia for longer. We were just the first part of it. And we flew back from Perth to Melbourne to Sydney to San Francisco to Detroit to Syracuse, New York, which is near Ithaca, and or relatively near Ithaca. And I have no idea how long it took. We were going to stay overnight in San Francisco, but after the long at that point, the flight from Sydney to San Francisco was the longest commercial flight. I think it was before the Hong Kong to San Francisco flight, which was longer. But it was long, and it was longer than the flight, our longest flight, the 11-hour flight. This was like 12 or some large number of hours. Mm. And so we just lost track of time. And so we booked our flights in San Francisco, and the only way we could do it was through Detroit. It was all weird connections. And but it was just very strange to come back. And in Ithaca, it snowed the next day, like a foot of snow. And so it's weird to go from 95 to large amounts of snow really fast. Mm. And that's the story of discovering them. And it was a really adventurous thing. And I was 25 when we did this. And I sort of look at the grad students now and sort of, I feel fortunate that I got involved in big discoveries so early.
What was it like when you, because eventually Voyager flew past the planet in the 1980s.
Right.
What was it like to see those images coming back and actually be able to see the rings in person for the first time?
It was pretty cool. Although what I was really interested in, I guess when you do occultations, you're really interested in precision measurements and distance. You look at distance and intensity things rather than just pretty. We didn't have pretty pictures. The pretty pictures were sort of generated by artists. And so it was, it's sort of anticlimactic in some ways to see an actual picture of the rings. It's a really fun thing to do. And we looked at things after that and we sort of found out stuff. Discovering something is really exciting. And it's really like a big, to me, it was a really big thing to get involved with. So it's pretty cool. So I never really wanted to do spectroscopy. I wanted to actually do geology or something like rover work or something like that. That was my plan when I was applying to go to Cornell. And I went off into this other field, which turned out I had the right skills for.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where it's exciting.
Thank you very much for sharing with us the story of your career and some of the highlights from it. It's been absolutely fascinating, Jessica.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to talk. I've really enjoyed this, and I learn more every time I tell the story.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Bateman and Ben Hewitt. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast, or Spotify.